Welcome to a special episode of Bible Study, Parody and Subversion in Matthew's Gospel. If you are looking for the actual Bible study through the Gospel of Matthew, I encourage you to go to episode 1 of this podcast and start there. This episode is a special bonus episode. This episode tells the story of my short sojourn in Palestine 22 years ago. And this is why I'm publishing this episode now. Although U.S.-based media mostly cloak it in other language and other framing, we are right now witnessing a genocide in Gaza. This genocide is happening with the full complicity and funding of the United States and is enthusiastically supported by many Christians in the United States. One reason for the widespread support for this violence is a misunderstanding of the actual situation and its history. And that is why I am publishing this episode. I recently came across a sermon that I had delivered at Pasadena Mennonite Church in August of 2001, just after returning from a Christian Peacemaker Team's delegation to Palestine. In it, I recount some of the history of the creation of Israel and what Palestinians refer to as the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic, and refers to the mass displacement and dispossession of the Palestinian people in 1948. But more importantly, in this sermon, I talk about the Palestinian response to the Nakba and the subsequent occupation in which Palestinians have been continually dispossessed and oppressed in many ways. While the U.S.-based media usually reports only the violent responses of Palestinians, the more common response has been nonviolent resistance. To say that the nonviolent response of Palestinians has been underreported would be a huge understatement. In U.S.-based media, it is all but absent. I would say completely absent, but I did see one story, I think it was an Associated Press report years ago, about a very creative, coordinated act of nonviolent resistance in the West Bank that involved people banging pots and pans. Some things slip through even in the U.S.-based media. But what I witnessed in the summer of 2001 was extraordinary. I think that there is a tendency in the West to assume that nonviolent strategies of resistance to oppression only happen in Western democracies, even though its most famous practitioners have been either non-Western or reacting to Western oppression, or both. For some reason, we continue to assume our moral and developmental superiority. Maybe that is why some readers of the Gospel can't see the nonviolent tactics of Jesus and his movement. They assume that since Jesus is not a modern Western person, he could not conceive of something like nonviolent resistance. But nonviolent resistance is not a modern or a Western phenomenon. Its roots are ancient and found in many places. As I reread my sermon from 22 years ago, I realized how much I'd forgotten, and I realized that what I said in that sermon might help other people to understand the situation in a very different way. So with some minor tweaks to update it, here is that sermon from 22 years ago. Naim Atik was 11 years old when the Israelis occupied his hometown of Bisan in 1948. The Israelis entered the town without a fight, not a shot fired, because Bisan, like many other Palestinian towns, had no defense, few if any guns. The Atik family had no guns. They didn't believe in having them. The Atik family was a devout Christian family. Their home had been a center of Christian activity. Their church's Sunday school was held in their home, as was the adult Bible study. Their home actually consisted of three modest houses sitting adjacent to each other. The first two housed the extended family. The third housed missionaries from England. They had a good life until it was disrupted by the Israeli occupation in 1948. They lived under occupation in Bizan for 2 weeks, and then the Israelis issued an order that all Palestinians would have to leave the town. Naeem's father pleaded with the Israelis to let their family stay, but they threatened to kill him if they did not comply with the order. They ordered all the people of Bizan to gather in the town square only hours after the original order was given. The Atik family, like all of the other families in Bizan, gathered what few possessions they could take with them and went to the town square where they were put on a bus. The Israelis separated the Christians from the Muslims. The Muslims were taken to the country of Transjordan, now known simply as Jordan, and left there. The Christians were taken to the town of Nazareth, which was yet to be occupied by the Israelis. A few weeks later, the Israelis occupied Nazareth as well. Naeem's father was a silver and goldsmith by trade, and at the age of 57 had to start all over again. While he and his family lived in other people's homes and in church shelters, he rebuilt his business, and even though he was a refugee himself, he got busy helping other refugees resettle. The Atik family lived under a brutal occupation as second-class citizens of the new state of Israel, not allowed to move about freely. 10 years later, on Israel's 10-year birthday, the Palestinians were allowed to move about freely for one day. The Atik family went back to their hometown of Bizan to see it again. No Palestinians lived there. The homes were all inhabited by Jewish Israeli families. The Anglican church had been converted into a warehouse. The Catholic church into a school. The Eastern Orthodox church was left to rot. The Atik's three houses were inhabited by Israeli families. They asked the inhabitants if they could come in and look around at their old home, but they were denied. One family emphatically told them, "This is our home, not yours." A short time later after that visit, Naeem's father had a stroke. He died 2 years later. Naeem Atik himself is now an Anglican priest and director of the Sabeel Center for Palestinian Liberation Theology in East Jerusalem. This was the first Palestinian Center for Nonviolent Resistance that I visited as part of a Christian Peacemaker Team's delegation to the West Bank. This was in August of 2001. Christian Peacemaker Teams is now known as Community Peacemaker Teams. During my sojourn in Palestine, I learned that the story of the Atik family was a very common one. Not only were their sufferings common to other Palestinians, in fact, many Palestinians have endured much greater suffering, but their response to the suffering and to the occupation is also very common among the Palestinian people. When I arrived in Palestine, I was already familiar with much of the tragic history of the place over the last 50 years. I knew that in 1948, between 750 and 800,000 Palestinians had been displaced from their villages and have never been allowed to return home, many of them still living in refugee camps and constituting the largest refugee population in the world today. I knew that the current occupation of the West Bank, which began in 1967, is a very brutal occupation in which Palestinians constantly have land taken from them by the Israeli government or military or by Israeli settlers, in which thousands of Palestinian homes have been demolished, leaving the inhabitants homeless, in which soldiers and settlers harass, bully, and sometimes kill Palestinians with impunity. The week before we arrived in Hebron, settlers had murdered two unarmed Palestinians on their way home from a wedding, one of them the bridegroom. These murders would not be prosecuted, nor would they be reported in the Western news media. I was familiar with all of these atrocities because I've been reading about them on a weekly basis in email updates from Israeli, Palestinian, and international peace groups. But what I was unprepared for, what caught me off guard, was the spirit of the Palestinian people and their response to the occupation. I was unprepared for how reasonable, how tolerant, how peace-loving, how forgiving and nonviolent most of them are. I'm not saying that most of them are doctrinal pacifists, although there are more of those than you might think, but that their actions, their response to the terrorism meted out against them, is largely nonviolent. Not in a passive way, but rather in a very active way. They dare to maintain their human dignity, their very humanity, in the face of incredible, inhuman brutality. They dare to live humanly under occupation. After spending a couple of days in East Jerusalem meeting with peace groups and doing nonviolence training, we started out on our first action. We went to the predominantly Christian town of Beit Jala to participate in the Human Shield Project of the International Solidarity Movement. We stayed 3 nights with families on the perimeter of the city who were most vulnerable to the Israeli shelling of these residential neighborhoods that had been occurring over the last 10 months. The first night, before dispersing to the homes of our assigned families, we were hosted at the home of a Palestinian man whose family had fled further into the West Bank to escape the shelling. He was a rather affluent man who owned 2 houses, one of them known as the Castle of Beit Jala. It was a large stone mansion that looked only to me vaguely like a castle. Perhaps it had looked more like a castle before it was bombarded by Israeli mortars. You see, this house was a favorite target of Israelis and was no longer inhabitable. He hosted us at his smaller house, which only had bullet holes from the shelling. That evening, we were served a feast and sat at table with 7 or 8 Palestinian men of the town. Among them were represented 4 or 5 Palestinian political parties. I don't think I've ever been at a table here in the U.S. where more than 3 parties are represented, no matter how large the group. Some of the men were Christian and others were Muslim. We had a vigorous political discussion, and I was impressed with the tolerance of these men for each other's political views and for our often obnoxious questions, which put them on the defensive. I was impressed with how democratic their spirit was. While they had many differences among them, they were united in certain things. They were all opposed to the occupation. They also all said that they were willing to live side by side with Jews, and they tended to favor a one-state solution, not the two-state solution that we hear so much about in the West. They believed it was entirely possible for Jews and Arabs to live side by side as equal citizens of one secular state. And they pointed to the long history of coexistence between Jews, Muslims, and Christians in Palestine before the Zionist movement. Then one of the men said something that I had never thought about. He's a Christian and stated that he comes from the same people as the Jews in Israel. He said, "Where do you think Christians here in Palestine came from? The first Palestinian Christians were Jews. And where do you think Palestinian Muslims come from? The first Palestinian Muslims were Christians and Jews. So all of us, whether Jews, Christians, or Muslims, are very likely of the same ancestry. But I am denied citizenship in Israel, and my right to live where my people have lived for centuries is being challenged by the Israelis." Later that evening, I and another delegate went to the home where I was to spend the night. We had a very vigorous political discussion there as well. We learned something about the shelling of Beit Jala. The shelling comes from 2 Israeli military positions on the opposing hill, right below the Israeli settlement of Gilo. Sometimes the Israelis start the shelling unprovoked, but often it is in response to sniper fire from a group of young men in Beit Jala. The town urges these young men not to fire at the Israelis, but they are not always successful, just as urban neighborhoods here in the U.S. find themselves unable to rein in their local gangs. But I found out why these young men of Beit Jala shoot at Gilo. The Israeli settlement of Gilo is built on farmland stolen from the families in Beit Jala. The family I was staying with has farmland that they lost to Gilo. So when the Israelis carry out an assassination or make some other provocative action somewhere else in the West Bank, the young men with the guns start shooting at Gilo. And the Israelis respond with a massive, hours-long military barrage, using much heavier firepower over residential neighborhoods. One group from our delegation was at a vantage point where they could observe the exchange between Gilo and Beit Jala and estimated that the ratio of firepower between Gilo and Beit Jala was 100-1 in favor of Gilo. The people of Beit Jala don't just try to urge the young men not to shoot out of concern for high ideals of peace. They try to stop the young men from shooting because they know that their town is hopelessly outgunned and they want to make it through the night alive. And they know that the Israeli forces are waiting for any excuse to bombard or even invade Beit Jala to make the conquest that began with Gilo complete. The first night that we were there, the Israelis shot 3 flares into Beit Jala. The family that I was staying with said that this was usually a sign that they would start shelling. But no shooting occurred that night, possibly because we immediately called the U.S. consulate to let them know that we were there. The next day, we visited the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement in Beit Sahur. This center led a successful indigenous, in other words, not Western, campaign of nonviolent resistance during the First Intifada, and was attempting to revive that campaign in this Intifada. What was impressive about these people is that they had paid the ultimate price of nonviolent resistance. Some of their members had been killed in their nonviolent struggle to resist the occupation. We, on the other hand, were very safe in comparison. They told us of a number of ways that they have resisted the occupation. In one action, they merely walked up to an Israeli military camp and began talking to the soldiers and passing out leaflets, informing them that they were no longer needed and were free to go home to their families in Israel, free to return to their carefree civilian life. It didn't work, but it made a statement. Next, we visited another nonviolent Palestinian activist in Bethlehem, and while we were there, we heard that the Israelis had assassinated Hamas leaders in Nablus and killed 2 children in the process. What was not reported here in the West was that the Hamas leaders were not military leaders. They were political leaders. You see, contrary to the propaganda that we hear here in the Western media, Hamas is not primarily a military operation. They are much more involved in building hospitals, schools, and orphanages than in carrying out military operations. The leaders that were assassinated were civilian leaders, not military leaders. The men of Beit Jala, who took upon themselves the responsibility of taking care of us, regretted to inform us that the word on the street was that there would be shooting between Beit Jala and Gilo that night. The shooting and shelling began before we were able to get to the homes. We were pinned down at the Lutheran church for a while, and the men of Beit Jala, being very protective of us, were very hesitant to let us take the risk of going out to the homes we were supposed to be staying in. They insisted that we stay in a part of the church that was partly underground and thought to be safe. With bullets flying into the courtyard of the church, I was in agreement with them. But the more courageous delegates and CPTers insisted on going to the homes, and when Palestinian TV announced our presence in the town, the Palestinian men relented and took significant personal risk, taking us to the various homes during the lulls of the shelling. These men took greater risks than we did since they had to drive everyone around town. We only went in groups one way to the homes, but the men never once thought of themselves, but were only concerned for our safety. The family that I stayed with was somewhat frightened and rattled, but mostly stayed calm and endured the night with much humor. That night in Beit Jala, we don't know who shot first, but the Israelis shelled the town for 6 hours. The family I stayed with was scared, but they made it through the night with quite a bit of humor. One thing they did involved the Palestinian TV station that showed a panoramic view of the lights of Beit Jala and Gilo. They figured out that one of the lights of Beit Jala was likely their house, so they flicked on and off the porch light and sure enough, found their house on TV. The next day we went out with a Beit Jala family to their farm in the countryside. This family can no longer go out on their own land for fear of being harassed by settlers or arrested by soldiers or Israeli police. Ever since an Israeli settlement was built close to their land and the settlers began harassing them, the Israeli government has challenged their right to the land. When the family showed them the deed and all the legal papers, they were told that that is not enough. They had to provide witnesses who knew the land belonged to them. So they took 20 witnesses to the court in Israel where they were instructed to go. They waited all day and no one saw them. When they came back on another day, their lawyer argued in court that the legal documents should be sufficient proof that they own the land. The judge responded that they, Israel, have documents too. The Bible declares that the land belongs to Israel. This family is still in a legal battle to defend their right to own the land they have owned for generations. We helped them harvest grapes and almonds, and the settlers and police and soldiers stayed away. The family hosted us to a wonderful meal, and we prayed and worshiped with them on the land. The next night in Beit Jala was relatively calm, and the following day we headed out for Hebron, known in Arabic as Al-Khalil. Our first stop in Hebron was at the Palestinian Center for Nonviolence, a local organization that leads campaigns of nonviolent resistance in Hebron. We then went to the CPT apartment in the old city of Hebron and found that that part of the city was under 24-hour curfew caused by the Israeli settlers trashing the marketplace. Of course, the settlers were not under curfew, only the Palestinians. The next night, we went in groups to stay with Palestinian families in the area who had been experiencing settler harassment. I and two other delegates and one full-time CPTer stayed at the home of the Jaber family. They have had to build their home four times. You see, their home is close to a settlement and has been demolished twice by the Israeli military and invaded and burnt once by settlers. Of course, no one was prosecuted. The father, Atta Jaber, speaks a fair amount of English, so we were able to have a very enlightening conversation. I wrote down some of the things he said. Here are some quotes from this peasant, Muslim, Palestinian farmer. "We want American people to demonstrate in Washington, D.C., and tell the White House they know the truth about who's starting the fighting. I want peace. I want to live in peace and be released from the occupation. 33 years of occupation is enough. Israel should send its young people to university to be doctors and engineers, not to war. Why isn't the money for tanks and weapons being used to build hospitals and universities and all the things we need? There is enough land. We can both live here together, Jews and Palestinians. We can stop the hating, the war between the two people. The U.S. should put more pressure on Israel. The position of the U.S. in the world is going down because more and more countries hate it. There is more power in the mind than in big muscles and strength. We must help all people who are poor and suffering if we believe in God. It is not enough to go to church or to mosque just to pray and do nothing." The words of a poor, uneducated Muslim farmer whose home has been destroyed three times, and who himself has been beaten by soldiers. A couple of days later, we were led by the Palestinian Land Defense Committee, yet another nonviolent activist group, and the mayor of Yatta to visit rural families in the Yatta area whose homes have been demolished three times by the Israeli military. They were demolished twice in the late 90s before an Israeli court decided they had the right to be there. But afterwards, a settler was found dead in the area. Rather than investigate the murder, it could have been done by another settler, the Israeli military demolished the homes again and killed numerous livestock in the process. When the Red Cross gave the families tents to live in, the Israeli military bulldozed the tents. The Palestinian Land Defense Committee, the mayor of Yatta, and the taxi drivers that transported us led us to the site at great personal risk. As expected, Israeli soldiers showed up and tried to separate the Palestinians from us so that they could beat them and destroy their vehicles. With the help of Israeli activists also at the site, we were able to avert the disaster. Through it all, the Palestinians never showed signs of fear or of becoming violent. While in Hebron, we also met with a journalist, Hisham Shirabati, who actively resists the occupation through writing about it. Like many Palestinian journalists, he has been beaten, arrested, and tortured by Israeli police and soldiers. At one point, he was denied 11 days of sleep, standing in one corner with his hands chained behind his back. He only told us this because we asked. He otherwise wouldn't have mentioned it. And he quickly added that it was nothing compared to what others have been through. We learned from him that during these torture sessions, the Israelis recruit collaborators. He was given the offer and refused. Also in Hebron, we worked with a translator named Salika, a petite woman about 4'11", who is a social worker and one of the few Palestinians who seems to be able to defy curfew. Despite her size, there is something about her personal presence which causes the soldiers to leave her alone. I could tell of many other brave and nonviolent Palestinians, but we don't have the time. All of these Palestinian families, individuals, and organizations maintain their humanity in the face of a brutal occupation, not passively, but actively resisting it. I can't help but think that this nonviolent resistance is the spirit of Jesus that lives on in the land. 2,000 years ago, Jesus, a Palestinian peasant living under occupation, walked the land, teaching his fellow peasants how to live humanly under occupation of Roman troops, how to resist the evil empire without taking on its spirit. When the Romans finally crushed the Jewish armed resistance, they removed the well-to-do classes from the land and dispersed them throughout the empire. But many peasants stayed behind. They weren't important enough to remove. These were the people of Jesus, the poor of the land. In time, many of them became Christians. Later, many of them were Arabized and became Muslim. Some remained Jews through it all. Perhaps it is the descendants of these Palestinian peasants, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, who live on in the land, still resisting the evil empire and its spirit. This time, an empire from further west. Ultimately, the reign of God is not about having the right theology, the right doctrinal statement. It's about living the way of Jesus, about having the same spirit that he had. It's about living like he did. It's about living out this new divine social order, this new reign of heaven, the reign of heaven that reconciles all things in love. We who are privileged by the empire can also pray that we are delivered from its satanic spirit, so that we can be in solidarity with those who, like Jesus, resist its occupation. How can we do that? We can pray for ourselves and for those who suffer from the violence of the occupation. We can write letters advocating for an end to the occupation. Perhaps more of us can go on delegations with Christian peacemaker teams, now known as community peacemaker teams. We can do all of these things, and in addition, we can endeavor to live more humanly, resisting the spiritual occupation of the empire. We may not suffer its physical violence, but we do suffer from its spiritual violence. We can live more generously, practice more hospitality. We can raise our children to love and not to hate, to love peace and insist on justice. We can make our homes places of worship and celebration, and our churches places of refuge. We can live humanly, defying the spirit of domination and empire. In this way, we will be in solidarity with the Palestinian people and with people everywhere who suffer under the violence of the powers and authorities of this present age, everywhere in the world. As Ada Jaber said, we must help those who are poor and suffering everywhere, if we believe in God. It is not enough just to go to church or to mosque to pray and do nothing.